It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. We focus on women in Appalachia this morning. First, why so many fall ill and die to cervical cancer and what is being done about it. Then, a talk with an author who writes about women who coped with violence in Mate One, West Virginia years ago. This is West Virginia Morning. Appalachian women face some of the highest rates of cervical cancer in the country. They're also among the groups of women least likely to receive cancer screenings. Ohio University professor Electra Pasquette has dedicated much of her career to understanding why. This year, she and her colleagues received a multi-million dollar grant aimed at cervical cancer prevention. Pasquette recently presented her work at West Virginia University's School of Public Health. Reporter Brittany Patterson caught up with her and brings us this conversation.
What initially drew you to studying cervical cancer in Appalachia?
So when I moved to the Ohio State University in 2002, I saw a map of the incidence, or the death rates actually, of cervical cancer in white women. And the Ohio area, especially the Appalachian area, was identified as one of the highest areas in the country for death rates for white women and cervical cancer.
So you definitely had some ideas going in as to what might be leading to the high levels of deaths from cervical cancer in Appalachia. And the first 5 years of your research here were focused on figuring out what those were. Tell us a little bit about what we're seeing.
So when we started the study, again, we wrote the grant in 2002. There were three factors that were related to cervical cancer. It was tobacco use, lack of pap screening, and HPV infection. So what we started out to do in the first 5 years was really qualify all of those. And we established the prevalence of smoking and actually tried to get women to stop smoking. We looked at the uptake of pap smear screening, and we did an intervention to increase the uptake of pap smear in women who were out of guidelines. The third project focused on quantifying the prevalence of HPV and high-risk HPV in the population, which we were able to do.
One of the things I found really interesting was there was some concern that the vaccine, people often know it as Gardasil, that prevents certain types of HPV, that may not be as effective here. And you looked into that specifically. What did you find?
Right. We thought that because women in Appalachia had experienced a lot of stress, mainly from the socioeconomic conditions as well as depression, that would affect the immune system, in that once given the Gardasil vaccine, they wouldn't be able to mount appropriate immune response. And we did not find that. We found that even women who have experiencing high levels of perceived stress, we found that women were still able to mount a strong immune reaction to the vaccine. So we were very relieved by that finding.
So in 12 years of research, we now have a better understanding of why we see more women in Appalachia facing cervical cancer than in the U.S. What comes next?
So what we're doing is we took all these factors, and we're working now with clinics in four Appalachian states. So that'll be West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, and Virginia. And we're working with 10 health systems, and we're going to be implementing a prevention program in those health systems that will focus on tobacco cessation, cervical cancer screening, and HPV vaccination. And we're going to be teaching the providers and the clinics how to offer that to their patients so that their patients can get all the aspects of cervical cancer prevention, and that it will not only focus on individual women, but it will focus on their family members, both their children and other family members who might smoke, for example. And so we call it a generational, family-based intervention delivered by the clinic.
It sounds like doctors and healthcare workers are really crucial players in trying to reduce cervical cancer.
They are. Healthcare providers and the entire clinic staff are integral players. You know, when you ask people, why did you stop smoking, or why did you get a mammogram, anything like that, those health behaviors, the number one reason is my doctor told me. So people really look to their healthcare professionals to give them advice about what they need to do to improve their health, to stay healthy. And the doctors need to be taught how to deliver those messages and how to help their patients do what the behavior is. You know, it's simple to say, oh, you need to stop smoking. Well, thank you very much, but how am I supposed to do that? And that's what we're going to be teaching the clinics, how to help their patients do that.
This is a problem that is really, I mean, all cancer in general is really challenging to solve, and especially on the prevention side of things. Looking toward the future, what is sort of your hope, and specifically in Appalachia, the barriers that we see here, are those things that your research says we might be able to overcome?
So that's a really good question. And, you know, a lot of the factors that impede people stopping smoking or getting screening exams is related to the social determinants of health. And how do we impact the social determinants of health? And I'll give you this example of a couple of them that clinicians have told me. Transportation. A lot of times it's hard to find transportation to get to the clinic because we don't have transportation services in our rural areas. And this clinician said the best thing. He said, we don't have Ruber, which is rural Uber. We don't have that. And so transportation is a real problem. It really is. And we have to look for innovative ways to address that. And the second problem he told me was communication. And we see that all the time, that you know, the rest of the world thinks that there's no digital divide. Well, there is a digital divide. I go to one clinic, and as soon as I turn off the highway, I lose cell service. So there is a digital divide. You have to embrace that, and you have to be able to figure out ways to communicate with patients that don't necessarily need the cell phone. We use patient navigation a lot, and the navigators, they work for the patients. They identify, why can't you come in for this pap test, or why don't you want to come in for the pap test? And then they can work on each individual barriers to obtaining the recommended care. It almost takes a village. But the issue is that you should not be blaming the individual patient for doing a risky behavior or not stopping a risky behavior. You have to dig deeper and find out, why is that person doing that or won't do that? And then you have to identify the root causes and deal with the root causes.
That was Ohio University Professor Electra Pasquette speaking to reporter Brittany Patterson about her research into cervical cancer in Appalachia. Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Marshall Health and Charleston Area Medical Center. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:51. Mostly sunny skies today with highs in the 30s, partly cloudy tonight, lows in the teens and 20s, mostly sunny tomorrow with highs in the 30s and 40s, and partly sunny on Friday with highs in the 40s. Support for the weather forecast is provided by Yeager Airport CRW, West Virginia's gateway to the world. More at YeagerAirport.com. Support is also provided by Pies and Pints in Charleston, Morgantown, and Fayetteville, featuring craft beer, hand-tossed pizza, char-grilled wings, and more for lunch, dinner, special events, and holiday parties. Details at piesandpints.net. In her new novel, Blood Creek, The Matewan Chronicles, author Kimberly Collins writes about the strikes that gripped the southern West Virginia coal fields in the early 20th century from the perspective of the women who lived through them. Eric Douglas interviewed Collins by Skype to find out more.
Hi, this is Kimberly Collins. I'm the author of Blood Creek.
Tell me about Blood Creek. Tell me what the story's about, but don't give away the ending, of course.
Okay. And it's so hard to talk about it without giving away all the good juicy details. So Blood Creek is the first in the Mingo Chronicles series, and I'm anticipating there will be three books total. And Blood Creek starts with the strike at Paint Creek and Cabin Creek, which took place in 1912. The story starts with a character named Ellie, and Ellie was a real person. The overarching theme of the book is the mine wars, and the thread that's kind of woven through the entire book, though, is the relationship of Ellie, her sister, and her cousin. So it's a book about relationships and just the fighting human spirit getting through some pretty dark, violent times in southern West Virginia.
Tell me why you started to approach this story from the female perspective.
So my cousin was telling me a couple of years ago some stories about her great-grandmother that I had never heard, that things that she went through after the Mate One massacre, which my great-grandfather was very involved in. And I knew in that moment that that was the story I needed to tell. And so the things that happened to her will come up in the next book in the series. But I just felt it was important to tell the women's stories because it's, you know, coal is a, it's a man's world. And the women really played a huge part in that. And I don't think that story is told enough, if at all.
So this is literally about your family or people that your family knew and interacted with in the day.
So Ellie was married to my brother-in-law's great-grandfather, Tom Chafin. And Tom is one of the main characters in the book. And I've really stuck to his story. So the massacre will continue with this same group of characters, but I'll be adding some of the characters that are related to me, my great-grandfather and great-grandmother and my great-uncles and a few other people. So it's a mixture of people that are directly related to me, a mixture of people that I know of.
A lot of people, when they think of the mine wars and whatever, they think of 1920. Why did you step back that previous decade?
Well, it wasn't my intention. When I started writing about the massacre in Mate One in 1920, and that was my focus. And I had actually never heard of Paint Creek and Cabin Creek. You know, there might have been just a blip on the history map growing up. But as I, when I discovered the story about Ellie and Tom, and I'm probably going to give some stuff away here, but Tom Chafin was married to Ellie. She was cheating on him with the police chief of Mate One. And so some things happened, and Tom ends up killing the police chief and the mayor. When I found that little tidbit buried in a book that I was doing for research on the massacre, I was fascinated with Ellie. And so I wanted to tell that story, but that happened in 1911. And I thought, well, what the heck else was going on in 1911? Because I need to weave this in somehow. And so I started doing a lot more research, and I came upon the Paint Creek, Cabin Creek strike.
So you said the next one will be more about the, or 1920 and the Mate One massacre. Yes. But this is a trilogy then?
Yes. So this book, Blood Creek, is Paint Creek, Cabin Creek. The next book, The Massacre, obviously is, it will pick up where this book leaves off, but I'm not going to linger too much in those years in between. But the book is about the massacre and the things that happened there in Mate One and all the things that happened after that. And then the third book will be about the Battle of Blair Mountain.
What did you personally learn from writing Blood Creek?
Writing this book and doing all the research, I realized that my heritage, my Appalachian heritage, is pretty amazing. And I'm more proud of it now than before I started writing this book, because I learned so much about the people of Appalachia and southern West Virginia, and that they were hardworking and intelligent and smart and clever and really fighting for their rights, and that all those things that came before me have made me who I am today.
The remaining two books in the Mate One Chronicles series are set around the Mate One Massacre and the Battle of Blair Mountain. This is part of an occasional series of stories featuring authors from or writing about the region. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.